Alabama, Johnny.
Not so long ago, I was reading Angela Davis's latest book, Are Prisons Obsolete? It was while reading this book that I learned about the convict lease system. This system arose in the south of the United States after the American Civil War in the late 19th century. It was the very early days of the existence of the penitentiary itself. The convict lease system involved the leasing of prisoners to private companies for the use of their labor. It was designed to re-enslave the African-American population after the official abolition of slavery. This not-so-well-known piece of American history seemed to me to be very relevant to today's expanding prison industrial complex. Here to help us learn more about the convict lease system is Alex Lichtenstein. He's an associate professor of history at Rice University in Houston, Texas. He's also the author of the book Twice the Work of Free Labor, The Political Economy of Convict Labor in the New South. So the U.S. 13th Amendment brought into law the abolition of slavery. Can you tell us how this amendment actually helped to open the door to the creation of the convict lease system?
Sure. The 13th Amendment was part of kind of an omnibus of constitutional amendments that came with the end of the Civil War, designed to, at least in theory, to emancipate and provide freedom and civil rights to African Americans who had previously been slaves, 4 million African Americans in the southern states or in the Confederacy. So for the states to re-enter the Union after the Civil War, they had to ratify the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Now, the 13th Amendment, as you say, was the one that technically abolished slavery. However, the way it was written was it abolished slavery except as punishment for a crime of which someone has been duly convicted. So, in part, I suppose that was written, the amendments were written by Northerners, and they had a convict system and a prison system under which people were laboring inside prisons. So they probably got nervous that the blanket 13th Amendment might put a stop to exploitation of convict labor in the North. So they left open that loophole, which in the context of the South immediately after the Civil War left open a very wide loophole for essentially a system of re-enslavement, but now using the criminal justice system instead of the notion of people as property as slaves, but people as criminals who could then be exploited as workers.
And what were the Black Codes?
The Black Codes were a system of laws that were passed by the local southern legislatures immediately after the Civil War in 1866, which criminalized or turned into felonies a whole wide battery of petty crimes, which they believed were being committed or would be committed by the freed slaves. These would be crimes such as vagrancy, very broadly defined, so that if you did not have proof of actually having a job, you would be convicted of vagrancy in 1866-1867. Similar, I would say, perhaps to the past laws of South Africa in the 20th century. These were supposedly neutrally drawn laws, but of course they almost always were applied to African Americans. So those Black Codes, as they were called, were designed to restore as much as possible a system of coercive labor race relations in the South after the Civil War. This, ironically, I think, did upset some people in the North who felt they had fought the war for no good reason if there was going to be re-enslavement, and did contribute to efforts to reconstruct the South on a different basis. But that loophole in the 13th Amendment still remained.
Can you tell us more about how this criminalization of blacks through the Black Code, how that actually worked into how the convict lease system worked?
Sure. Well, what you had happening in the first first years after the Civil War, so we're talking 1866, 1867, 1868, was with this criminalization of the black poor, of the freed slaves. You had hundreds of them, thousands really, in each state being drawn into the criminal justice system, sent to the penitentiary. There was one problem, however, most of these states there was no penitentiary. That is, there was no physical penitentiary. Either it had been destroyed during the war, all the prisoners who had, before the war, simply been white, not black, because slaves would be disciplined by their masters, the prisoners had escaped, or the pre-war penitentiaries in the South were extremely inadequate. They were small. They had a few hundred convicts because most of the people who would have been sent to them were slaves. So after the war, the southern states are simultaneously confronted with the problem of convicting of these new crimes hundreds or thousands of new prisoners, but not having any place to send them physically. And secondly, being broke. The South was broke. There was no fiscal possibility of establishing a public penitentiary system in which to put these people. So that combination of kind of the physical lack of space, the physical constraints of the Reconstruction period, and the criminalization of the black poor, I think, together led down the road to this privatized system of leasing the prisoners out to private contractors.
Can you give us some more details on how the system actually worked?
One of the things I discovered when I did my research that surprised me was I had assumed, and I think a lot of people assumed, that this was a slave-like system that would restore black convicts to plantation labor, that it would force them into working on the farms and on the plantations where they worked as slaves. But in fact, I discovered when I did my research that that wasn't the case at all, that it operated as a system of taking criminalized African Americans and taking their labor and sending it into economic sectors which were very hungry for labor in that period. So a prisoner might be convicted of a petty crime, theft, sentenced to 10 years in the quote-unquote penitentiary, which was really just a virtual or a fictive penitentiary, and then a operator of a coal mine or a turpentine farm or someone who was building railroad tracks very important expansion of the railroads in those late 1860s for the South to recover economically would come in and essentially buy that prisoner, would pay the state a certain amount of money in order to contain and control that prisoner in their branch of the penitentiary, which was essentially a coal mine, a railroad camp, brick plant, turpentine farm, and so forth. So the penitentiary, as it was called, should, in that period, I think, can be put in quotes. It wasn't really a penitentiary. It was the farming out, as they said, of these convicts, but not to farms.
And what were the conditions like for the prisoners who were leased out to these private companies?
Well, as you can imagine, not very good, in part because they were simply buying the prisoner's labor, and if one prisoner happened to die while at work, the contractor would have an instantaneous claim on another prisoner who would be sent to the penitentiary, right? They wouldn't have to pay damages, they wouldn't have to buy another slave. They would have already paid their annual fee, so this was replaceable labor, very different than slavery in that sense. So that many of the accounts that you read of this system would say, actually, it was even more brutal in some ways than slavery, precisely because there was no investment in the body of the prisoner. They were just purchasing their labor, and therefore in a position to work them to death. And also, similar to, I noticed you were going to connect this to discussions of privatization today, for a contractor to make money, as private prison contractors make today, they want to reduce costs, which means health care, food, basic sanitary facilities, the amount of money that you're going to pay the guards in the system, all of that is reduced to a bare minimum, which also made the conditions quite horrific in these convict camps.
And how did it play into the economics and the industrialization of the time?
Well, one of the things I discovered, again, that surprised me, I think when the older accounts of this form of labor, if it was acknowledged at all, it would often be regarded as kind of one of these backwards, archaic, darker corners of the South, something that was unfortunate and perhaps even evil, but not part of the mainstream and the main currents of Southern history in the late 19th century. And so I was really surprised to discover that I didn't think that was the case, that in fact much of this labor was used and sent to the heart of the recovering Southern economy, so that the railroads that had to be built in the 1860s used this labor. The coal mines that were the base of some industrialization in a place like Birmingham, Alabama, which had iron furnaces and steel mills, the coal that went into those iron furnaces and steel mills was mined by convict labor. So, in fact, I discovered it was quite important. Actually, one of the pieces of evidence I had for this was that, I wish I could recall the date, but sometime in the 1890s, Canada started refusing to import pig iron from the Birmingham district of Alabama because, in their view, it was being produced by slave labor because convicts were mining the coal that lay at the base of that particular industrial complex. So I argued in my book that that prison labor, forced labor, convict labor, black labor under these conditions was actually quite central to the economic recovery of the American South after the Civil War.
And how did the racist mentality of slavery and of the time affect the whole process of going from slavery to the convict lease system in that period of time?
It was quite significant in a couple of ways. First of all, as I said, prior to slave emancipation, the penitentiary system in the South was very underdeveloped because it essentially was for whites only. And blacks would be punished by the slave system. They'd be punished corporally, or they'd be physically chastised. But of course, a master wouldn't want a slave being locked up in the penitentiary. That would be very economically useful. So immediately after the Civil War, the system then is aimed at punishing African Americans, and then as the system clearly falls into disrepute, whites kind of escape from it. So that the flip side of that is that juries, for instance, and judges and prosecutors are very, very reluctant to enslave whites under the system that's designed for blacks. As I say somewhere in my book, if you look at the statistics, if you go by incarceration rates, the South in 1900, white Southerners are the most law-abiding populace in the entire world, if you measure by incarceration rates. Of course, that's absurd. We know that there's plenty of crime going on, and indeed the South has this reputation, the white South has a reputation for being an exceedingly violent place in 1900. But whites are not being sent to the penitentiary system precisely because it is understood as a system of slavery that's designed for African Americans. When whites are convicted, they get sent to the county farm. That is, these states do retain a small, actual walled penitentiary, which tends to be for whites, while blacks are farmed out into the convict lease system. On those rare occasions when whites might end up in one of these convict lease camps, they would often then be put into positions as supervisors, as bookkeepers, as people working outside of the mines, for instance, and not be sent down into the mines. So it was shot through from beginning to end with racism. And indeed, I would say that the very fact of this convict system being used as a form of enslavement often let whites off the hook. Those whites were not being sent to the penitentiary.
What kind of resistance was there, both, you know, within the prisoner population, but also outside in the broader community, to the convict lease system?
Well, one of the things I show in my book is, although I think that the opportunity for resistance under the system was limited because of its brutality, but the best way that convicts themselves could resist was simply to resist working, that is, to work more slowly or to work inefficiently. So in the coal mines, one of the things some of these mine operators discover is that a lot of the coal cars are filled with slate and impurities because convicts aren't exactly working efficiently. They're not interested in digging good coal. They're just interested in getting through the day without being punished. So I think that was the most obvious form of resistance that I would discover. Also, sometimes sabotaging the mines, lighting fires in the mines, that sort of thing is definitely quite evident. In terms of resistance outside of the mines, reason, some more progressive than others. Some capitalists, of course, those people who hadn't gotten the convict contracts, they weren't real happy about the system. They wanted to get their hands on that labor or not be undercut by that cheap competition. So sometimes other mine owners, other railroad builders would object. The labor movement, of course, not surprisingly, weak as it was in the South, did mount an attack on the convict lease system in a place like Georgia, especially. There was a concerted effort in Atlanta of the organized labor movement around 1900, 1905 to take the convicts out of the mines and out of the brickyards because they were seen as unfair competition. In Tennessee in the 1890s, there was an armed rebellion of free coal miners who objected to the use of convict labor in the mines, and they actually removed the convicts from the mines, burnt down the stockade, put the convicts on a train, and sent them back to the state legislature in Nashville. So there were those sort of activities certainly going on, and that did help bring the system into disrepute and led to some reforms.
And how and when did the convict lease system end in the South?
Well, the convict lease system is different in every state. So it's abolished or transformed from the 1890s on until, I think, 1928 is the last remnant of it. That's abolished in Alabama in 1928. Now, one of the things in many of these states that you find is that the convict lease is replaced by a system called the chain gang system. That is, public work on the roads controlled by the state, but working in chains as chain gangs. The great irony, I think, is it's only maybe 10, 20, 30 years later in the 1930s that the chain gang itself becomes the symbol of Southern brutality and sort of medieval torture in its convict system, mostly through a film which maybe even Canadians are aware of called I'm a Fugitive from the Chain Gang, which was shown in the 1930s, very famous film. The irony is this chain gang system itself was initiated in the progressive era, turn of the century, as a reform, as an alternative to the convict lease system. So you would have that. You would have the development of the chain gang system, or another great irony, the other reform in some states like Mississippi or Louisiana. They abolish the convict lease. They take the convicts and they put them on a notorious prison farm, Parchment Penitentiary in Mississippi, Angola Penitentiary in Louisiana. These are the most horrific institutions, penal institutions, really in North America when they're established 100 years ago. But they actually were pitched as reforms, as alternatives to the private leasing of convicts, returning them to the control of the state. But the state often proves to be as brutal a master as the private contractors under these circumstances.
So the chain gangs were then, the difference between the convict lease system and the chain gangs is that the chain gangs, their labor was controlled by the state, no longer leased out to private companies, is that?
Right, in other words, controlled by public authorities, more often local counties than the state. In other words, state oversight was quite lax, and the counties and the county commissioners and the local authorities would have the opportunity to take this labor and go build someone's road with it. They would improve the roads for their neighbors using forced black labor. It also played, unfortunately, the chain gang system would play into the peonage system, which was the way of having people work out a debt for a farmer or turpentine owner. And frequently, a black sharecropper might be convicted of a petty crime and be given the alternative, 6 months on the chain gang, or this farmer will pay your fine and your court costs, and you can go work it out for him for 6 months. So some people would choose that alternative, which then would put them right back into a system of private slavery or debt peonage, really.
How does this history of the convict lease system and evolution of chain gangs inform the use of prison labor and privatization in our current prison system?
Unfortunately, there are two ways to answer that question. One way is that it doesn't inform it at all, and that people seem to have short memories. So as the privatization of prisons begins to grow, which especially in the South, as a matter of fact, I was just looking at some figures on this. Texas, for instance, has one of the most rapidly growing private sector economies in the prison system, private prison system. But people don't seem to remember that we've been there and done that 100 years ago the system was in existence, and it was a horrific system. On the other hand, I think many of the same dynamics are at work. That is, states are eager to save money. Privatization is seen as the way to go. As I'm sure your listeners know, the United States has an extremely large prison population and one that is racialized. That is, African-Americans and Hispanics and people of color are caught up in the machinery of criminal justice in a way that whites are not, often because they are subject to laws which are not applied to whites, because the decisions that are made by prosecutors, by juries, by judges, and so on. So the privatized system that's emerging today has some unfortunate echoes with the past, especially with this notion of cost-cutting measures as well that lead to bad conditions. But people don't really seem to have that historical memory or that historical vision that allows them to think that this might be a bad idea.
And where can people find out more information about this if they want to look into it more or read up on some of the current issues around privatization and the use of prison labor?
There are a number of places to look. For me, the best site, maybe because my book is on and I was quite flattered to see that, is a website called prisonsucks.com. One word, prisonsucks.com. That has lots of information, lots of links, and a nice kind of list of books all the way from the academic, hyper-academic, unreadable book like my own to much more popular and better versions across the board. I also found a lot of information on the Department of Justice website. Say what you will about the American government, but they do keep a lot of records. So if you go to BJS, Bureau of Justice Statistics, .gov, I don't know if it's Canada, that has to be U.S. as well, but maybe not, maybe U.S. is gov. They have all sorts of great links and statistics on private prisons and studies of private prisons and so forth, so that would be an interesting place to look as well.
Old Alabama, Johnny.
We have been speaking with Alex Lichtenstein. He's an associate professor of history at Rice University in Houston, Texas. And we were talking about the convict lease system. It was a system that saw prisoners leased to private companies in the late 19th century in the southern U.S. Alex is the author of the book, Twice the Work of Free Labor, The Political Economy of Convict Labor in the New South, published by Verso. And again, for those websites, you can check prisonsucks.com or bjs.gov.
Did you hear about that?